I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum, Executive Dean of most of the University of Notre Dame, Australia. Welcome back, Martin.
It's always good to join you, Michael.
So are you peripatetic this week? Are you in Broome or Perth, Fremantle, possibly New York for the UN or Sydney? Tell us.
I didn't quite make it to New York for the UN, but I have made it as far as Sydney. So 4,000 k's away from you at the moment, Michael, but it's always good to be here.
Well, the UN, of course, is based in New York. You and I have been there. One of the last times I was there, I have to tell you, there was a huge display advocating for Palestinian statehood and the two-state solution. It is fascinating. This is probably at least 15 years ago that it seems to be happening around us. But let's try and take it in some sort of chronological order, at least so far as performances are concerned. We had this spectacle of President Trump of the United States speaking at the UN, and he seemed to let it all hang out, Martin. What did you make of his address?
Well, no one would accuse Donald Trump of not speaking his mind. I think that much is clear. So he turns up at the UN and then bags out the UN for everything from mass immigration and climate change right through to elevators not working. Which is astonishing. And the part that I thought was funny was the elevator's not working, because for people who have been hiding in a hole, because you can't ignore Trump, he's everywhere. Apparently he and his entourage, including the First Lady, tried to go up an elevator and it stopped. And in his mind, it was a conspiracy by the UN. But it would appear that early investigations suggest it was his own team that somehow tripped the elevator, which I thought was very amusing. Anyway, I'm off topic a little bit, but he was scathing about the UN's role in the world. He basically described them as a failure. They weren't living up to their mandate, and they were making problems worse. It was quite astonishing. He described climate change as the world's biggest hoax. In fact, his comments were at odds with the vast majority of speakers who lined up at that UN. And people contrasted those comments with those of the Chinese president, who said, climate change is real, I'm going to do something about it, we believe in peace and working together and all of these things. It's the kind of the opposite of what you would expect the US and China normally to make maybe 20, 30 years ago.
It really is astonishing, but let's segue to our own Prime Minister, Albanese, who's been getting quite big raps while he's there. He's been fashioned into a statesman with quotes around it, something he probably thought he would never quite be. He's been off to big editorial meetings at the New York Times, who apparently think that all Australian political parties are on side when it comes to climate change and net zero. We can come back to that and Andrew Hastie and what he's up to in a little while. But he's obviously had a great time. I mean, you can't help but have a good time when you're in New York, at least in the old days. What do you make of Albo's performance? What's his angle? What's he up to?
Well, I think his angle has always been to be affable, to get along with most world leaders, and to try to incrementally advance Australia's agenda. And it was a fairly inoffensive talk that was clearly tailored to the audience. There was a clear domestic audience, as all good leaders are mindful of. And it appeared that he was pretty well received in a lot of quarters. He was mostly falling in line with other countries' broader agendas. But there were a couple of significant ones. Of course, this was the culmination of the recognition of Palestine as a state, formally before the UN. That was an important part. And the other part that he sought to really hammer home perhaps a bit more is this social media ban, Michael. So he was sort of trumpeting that around the place. He had even the head of the EU on board, etc. It's a policy I've got some personal reservations about, but nevertheless, it appeared in theory at least to be fairly popular amongst some of the other countries.
It is an interesting one. It sort of shows something new and fresh. You don't think of it as a world stage item, but it is something social media that affects people everywhere. And we'll come back and look at it at some later time. Of course, a lot of the pre-show publicity was whether Albanese would get to see, meet, shake hands, get a photograph with Trumpy. And of course, it happened at the No doubt it took weeks and months of manipulating and agreeing for the accidental meeting in the hallway to take place, where they shook hands and beamed at each other. And then, of course, we heard that that our PM is going back in about a month's time to have a proper sit down in DC in the White House. What do you make of all of that? Does that suggest that there isn't so much tension as the media likes to play up?
I never thought that there was tension. I always thought that basically Trump has other fish to fry. We're never at the front of the queue, I don't think. It would only be if there was an issue that broke out in our area where he really needed our support, and then suddenly we'd be further up the queue. I've not heard Trump say a bad word about Albanese. I've not. I think Albanese himself has been very guarded in his remarks about Trump and sort. To talk up their relationship. So I think that was a bit of a media beat up from the start, the sort of the so-called tension between them. Even though they do differ markedly on some of these policy issues like climate change and Palestine, so does most of the rest of the world with Trump on this. So why would he single out Australia for a particular reckoning? I think October the 20th, they'll be meeting up. I expect that to go pretty well. Trump is very unpredictable. You never quite know what you're going to get, but there's no reason to assume that they have that. There's that tricky issue of tariffs that our prime minister will have to bring up. I'm not sure what he'll gain there, but that's probably, if you ask me, the trickiest issue because we have some. This really hurts our economy. We're an export-related economy, so Alba really does have to advance that. But I think there's every indication that the two of them like one another.
I suspect the biggest announcement that will come out of it, at least from a domestic point of view, in a West Australian point of view, in a Fremantle point of view, Martin, will be that AUKUS.
AUKUS, yeah.
AUKUS is happening, and there was a report today that the very smug Richard Marles, he doesn't seem to be able to avoid a standing demeanour of smugness, our Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, but he muttered something which sounded like he thought it was all in the bag. And there'll be an announcement, I reckon, for sure. What do you think?
I think so. It would appear that it's another one of those issues. Most of the time, these issues are kind of lined up, packaged away, neatly worked out before leaders meet. Now, Trump has sort of rewrote that script a little bit in some of his conversations. But on the whole, it would appear the signaling we're getting is that the US is comfortable with this relationship and so are ourselves. You know, we've unpacked AUKUS a number of times. Raised various issues, etc. But it would appear that the two governments are determined to push ahead.
Well, some of the things you can't be quite sure about there, as you say, that President Trump, both in his UN speech, but after it as well, when pressed in question, the questions of Ukraine and also Gaza slash West Bank, the Palestinian question, keep coming up. And there are, I don't know if they're throwaway lines or what the president is suggesting the US's possible involvement or position is in relation to Ukraine. What have you made of all of the utterances?
Look, Ukraine is such a confusing thing from Trump's perspective. You'd never know what he's going to say next. So we've gone from him demanding basically Ukraine surrender various portions of eastern Ukraine to that was only weeks ago, Michael, to now saying, well, you might be able to push them out of the lot. It's astonishing. This latest thing where he's seems to be backing Ukraine in to defeat Russia militarily. I think it's more of a throwaway line, Michael. I'm not hinging too much on it. There's no extra promise at all from the US to help make that happen. And in fact, under the current agreement, US arms have ceased, direct arming of Ukraine has ceased, and they're now agreeing to provide arms that the European Union pays for. So, you know, unless the European Union are prepared to cough up a lot more money, I can't see that changing enormously.
And at the same time, we've got Russian jets flitting around various parts of the Baltic, Martin, the sort of infringements that, in the case of the first war at least, could well see a spark that starts a big war.
This is actually Michael, the more significant development, not one throwaway line from Donald Trump, which may not mean anything. If Russia keeps infringing upon NATO countries' airspace, that's a serious matter. And sooner or later, I would expect one of those countries with, say, French or British support, perhaps, will shoot down that aircraft. And if they do, then how does Russia respond? So that is a real life escalation point that could make things much messier. Poland's already suggested that they will.
There's no doubt that has to be the fearsome point. We don't seek to over-dramatize or try and create fear on View from the Roundhouse, but people who are students of history and how wars start are aware that tensions can spill over very quickly with a spark like that. Let's not linger on it too long. I mean, the other place where they're no longer just sparked, it's just all-out war, is Gaza, where the Israeli Defense Forces are in there. People are being killed. I think Hamas fighters as well as other Palestinian people. But Trump's position on West Bank seemed to be a bit stronger than not just a throwaway line.
Again, another area where you're getting waxing and waning at one time or another. Let's put this in context. The Palestinian Authority has, which is regarded widely as the more moderate Palestinian leadership, and most countries see it as playing some kind of role, even if it's just transitional, in a formation of a Palestinian state. They were not even given a visa to come to the US. So, they're not even allowed to come and speak in New York, and they had to do it online. So there's very little indication from Trump that he sees them as any kind of legitimate actor. I've got plenty of concerns about the authority myself in terms of corruption and a whole range of other things. But if it's not them, who is actually going to be providing some kind of transition administration? Everyone's saying Hamas can't be involved, but you do really wonder whether there's any pathway to peace if that's the case.
And then the question of the West Bank, I mean, every indication is that the Israeli Defense Cabinet would love to annex the whole lot of the West Bank. Trump does seem to have told them they shouldn't.
Yes, you're right to pick up on that. And again, how much does he want to actually intervene to make sure that doesn't happen? All long-term observers in this conflict will tell you that the settlements in the West Bank are fast making the geographic setup of a Palestinian state non-viable, just because they're encroaching on so many different areas that there's not contiguous, which is a fancy word to say access between the various parts of Palestinian-controlled land, to for you to actually run an administration. So unless that's halted and stopped and in maybe reverse, which would be very controversial from the Israeli side. How are you going to have a viable Palestinian domain?
People often forget that there's a significant Palestinian population that lives in the West Bank. We've been so concentrated on Gaza, but I think there's as many as a couple of million in the West Bank, Martin.
And that's traditionally been where the headquarters of a Palestinian state. More recently, it's about 17, 18 years old now. There's a final complete split between Gaza and the West Bank, but traditionally that had been the heart of Palestinian controlled territory.
Now, we've all seen the announcements on Palestine. We've had UK, Canada, Australia, France waited till the magic moment at the UN, but you've got a whole range of countries who've come out there. And now our PM has flown into or is about to fly into the UK to meet Keir Starmer. What's that all about? Is that just more AUKUS, and or is it? Or is it just he's on a whatever that is, a clockwise tour of the world?
I think there is something quite meaningful here. Let's go through a couple of things. Firstly, AUKUS, the channel to make AUKUS work is in part through the UK. And you actually saw the King, no less, mention it in a speech before Trump. Australia, US, and UK working together. So Trump has some sympathy for the UK. I think it's more of an angle. We talked about this before. It's this sort of the Anglo past of Trump. He sees it as a bit different from other European countries. He has a reasonably warm relationship with Starmer, despite them disagreeing on issues. So for Albanese to be effective in some kind of relationship with Trump and maybe move tariffs along, etc., a good relationship with Starmer helps. Certainly helps with AUKUS from his perspective. And there's other ways in which Australia is looking to work directly with the UK. So I think it's quite an important strategic meeting. Everyone talks about Trump, but still, I think Starmer is important to him.
Well, when he gets back, that is when the Prime Minister gets back to Australia and gets along to the next sittings of Parliament, he'll find there's no doubt any more that the Teal or independent Nicolette Birler has won the seat of Bradfield. It's taken a long time to work out since the last election, Martin, and Gisela Kapterian, the Liberal hopeful, who lost it on a handful of votes, really has lost. I guess we lost sight of all of that. In one sense, it didn't really matter, but I think it does sort of matter, Martin. What do you think?
It does. As someone like myself is always focused on elections and voting, a little tiny bit of context for listeners. This is the final seat of the 150 seats. The closest seat, there was just 26 votes in counting in that seat. Extraordinary. And the Liberal candidate had exercised her democratic right, mind you, and challenging this in the Court of Disputed Returns, and decided to discontinue, presumably because she hadn't found enough direct evidence that might overturn that result. It's in the case of our democracy working. You always hear about controversies, etc., but this is we do have well-run elections in Australia, and it's basically drawing a line under the 25 election and saying the results that came in were accurate and fair and reasonable and were counted correctly, which is important.
Well, the other part of the democratic process is you can belong to a political party. You might even be in a political party that's in opposition or in coalition with another party in coalition, but you can apparently speak your mind, but only to a certain extent. We've been seeing the West Australian member Andrew Hastie speaking up about immigration and this and that, but he still says that he loves his leader. It's all sorts of biblical precedents for these things, Martin, but what's Hastie up to? I mean, he seems to be a good-looking guy. He's got this wonderful military background, and he seems to be a loyal Christian. He's everything that many people in the coalition love. And some people are wanting to promote him into the top spot. And I think he probably wants to be there, Martin. Is it a question of just biding his time?
I think there is certainly plenty going on in this space. This is a guy who's on the front bench of the Liberal Party, who's now speaking his mind on a range of issues, making his leader feel distinctly uncomfortable, of course threatening to resign if net zero is adopted. I think he's absolutely positioning himself as an alternative to the leader. I think he's aware that polling for the Liberal Party is extremely poor at the moment. I think he knows that a direct challenge to Lei would look really bad. I mean, she's only just stepped into the role virtually. She's been in there for a few months. It's way too soon, in my view, for anyone like that to be challenging. But I think he's also running on issues that he knows the membership and parts of the party room care about, like mass immigration, in his view. That's as he describes it. So that's actually. I think that's a really deliberate strategy. It's not just him speaking his mind, which we all welcome in politics. And I think it's good if he stands up for things he believes in. I think also he's a formidable challenger, for the reasons you mentioned. He's not just MAGA that he's sometimes portrayed in the media. He's more of a traditional conservative, and so I think he'll be quite popular with the base, but. I just think this is too early to be looking at a change in Liberal leadership.
It sort of reminded me as it's gone along of the very traditional way that people who are very loyal to their party but nonetheless have their own ambitions behave. Hawke and Keating is a very good example, isn't it? The context was different, but Keating then just separated him away. He even went on the back bench for a while, didn't he?
So I did think that's part of this performative. You throw some meaty issues out there, talk about how you're different. You've got your policy platform written for you. If you're sacked, you're a martyr. and you just bide your time on the back bench and you make it look like it's differences of a policy rather than just personality.
Well, I don't know what the policy differences are when you come to the mayoral election in Fremantle, Martin, but there are probably some personality differences. The five candidates running for mayor, we mentioned this last week, the postal votes have arrived in our letterboxes, so Fremantle people are probably over the next few days and early next week sending their postal votes in. The election, in one way, will be all over by the end of next week, I suspect. Before we have the great mayoral debate at Notre Dame Tannock Hall in Fremantle at 6 p.m. on Monday the 6th of October, Martin. But have you been sort of keeping your finger on the pulse? Can you tell whether one candidate's doing better than the other?
It's notoriously difficult. It's not like we've got polling or anything, Michael, to work off in this respect. All you've got is five different candidates. It's optional preferential voting, which is rather interesting. It means that some of those candidates, when they drop out, will be able to preference others. So there may be some advantage from candidates who have other like-minded candidates running. But under optional preferential voting, they don't all those preferences don't flow through. So plenty of them exhaust. Now I'm getting into a bit of technicality there, but what I'm saying is it's all this makes the result fairly unpredictable this time around, especially with five different candidates. And we're seeing all of them get out and about and be quite active, vocal, a lot of signage in and around Fremantle, Michael. And we do enjoy a good contest here at the Fremantle Shipping News.
Well, one of the candidates has even gone to the extreme that you normally only get in national and state political campaigns of bombarding people in Fremantle with text messages to support her candidature. I've written asking, as I think most people have asked, how did you get hold of my number? But I haven't had any reply from the candidate. It probably is just a good indication that this is a pretty earnest election campaign period, Martin.
And do people like unsolicited text messages? You've got to look at your tactics, wonder whether, what this sort of cost-benefit analysis, and wonder whether you're shifting votes or whether you're just frustrating people. I guess at local government level, a lot of people are just trying to get their name out there and be recognised. But there's always a bit of a risk there.
I'm sure there is anyway. The votes will all be in before we know it. Interesting to see whether there's a higher percentage of people voting in Fremantle and whether there's some sort of hangover from the Kate Hewlett politics of recent times, where Fremantle people have shown a distinct desire to have someone quite independent representing them in important offices. Do you have a sense that that might be the case?
Oh, I think that's definitely there's an attraction there. And Kate Hewlett's performance at state and federal level was remarkable, really, in Fremantle. But ostensibly, everyone who stands for local government is independent. None of them are running under a specific party tag. Some of them will have closer connections to parties than others, perhaps, and that's for voters to ask and inquire and investigate, etc. But I would say all of those five contenders absolutely have the ability to act independently and make their own call on all of those issues that matter.
Well, Martin, we'll find out. There'll no doubt be a range of searching questions at the Great Mayoral Debate on the 6th of October. Just remind people who are in Frio that they need to register because you want to get yourself a seat, and we think it's going to be well and truly sold out. Having said that, Martin, lovely talking to you as always, and we'll chat again next Friday.
Looking forward to it. It's going to be great.